Save big on your landscaping project now at Menards. Whether you're installing a patio or a new retaining wall, Menards has the blocks you need to get the job done right. We carry the largest in-stock selection ready to take home today. Stop in and get our 12-inch smooth patio block on sale now. Save big on concrete landscape blocks at Menards. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now. Save big.
This week on Lunchbox Envy, there is a hospital in Papua New Guinea where one in 40 visitors to A&E have been hit on the head by one.
That's so funny. In 2013, police in the Maldives detained one on suspicion of vote rigging in the local election.
And in Swahili, they're called Nazis.
No, it's coconuts. And welcome to Lunchbox Envy. I'm Manu and I'm here with my fellow QI elf, Jack. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Manu.
And chef and food writer, Rosie. Hello, Rosie.
Good afternoon.
Jack, I couldn't help noticing you talk about Nazis earlier.
Yeah, they came up surprisingly quickly.
No, well, it's just a sort of strange coincidence that the word for coconut in Swahili is spelled N-A-Z-I, although it's pronounced Nazi, just like Winston Churchill used to say, we shall fight them on the beaches, these dreadful Nazis.
I didn't know that he used to say it like that.
He was sort of deliberately mocking them by mispronouncing the German, because in German it would be S sound. But anyway,
yeah.
We're straying off topic here. But it was interesting, is the a word for the coconut, Nazi, doesn't come from Bantu, which is the language that came before Swahili in that area, East Africa. It likely comes from the Persian word narjil, which was passed through trade. We always talk about the Silk Road and the Columbian Exchange, but there's a lot of trade going on between the Middle East and East Africa.
Right.
Yeah, in fact, the Sultan of Oman lived in Zanzibar for a while. For some reason.
Do either of you, and I expecting you to know where the word coconut comes from?
Yes. It's actually very cute, I think.
Yeah. Is it?
Good. So the cocoa part is from the Portuguese word for grinning or grimacing face because of these little three indents.
Oh my God. On the bottom. The coconutty smile. It kind of looks like the face of a sloth. You know what I mean?
That one does.
If you did like a game where it was like just really, really tight images of coconuts or sloth faces, and then the game was, which one is it, coconut or sloth? It
presented like a capture.
Yeah, exactly.
Tick all photographs of sloths.
Tickle the sloths.
And the nut section?
So the nut is because they look like a nut, but they are not a nut.
Of course they're not a nut.
They are a drupe, which is a fruit. So it is a fruit. And it's got a hard covering that encloses the seed, and it comes from the word drupa, which means an overripe olive. So coconuts are drupes, walnuts also drupes. A lot of foods that we think are nuts are actually this kind of droopy fruit.
Like things with hard, really hard exoshells. Exoshell is a technical term I've just made up.
Yeah, I like it. So drupes have three layers. The exocarp, outer layer, very
thank
close.
You.
The mesocarp, which is the fleshy middle layer. And then the endocarp, which is the hard woody layer that surrounds the seed.
Mm.
Right.
So yeah, if you imagine a peach, the skin is the exocarp and then the flesh is a mesocarp and then the stone is the endocarp. A peach has the same structure, but because it's so small, we don't really sort of think of the bit inside. And also it doesn't contain water. I think that's quite unique to the coconut, is the endocarp contains water and a bit of air, right?
Which is why it's able to float.
Wow, they can float. I didn't know that. We could be bobbing for coconuts. We haven't done that. Why not?
Another word which we could drop into conversation is testa. T-E-S-T-A. That is the bit, once you've opened your endocarp, you've got all the white flesh. I don't know if you've ever experienced, there's like a thin skin to it, which is edible, but not particularly nice. That's called the tester.
Right. So is the reason why you brought this up because droop and tester sound like they're referring to testicles?
No, you made that.
Oh, just me.
I was just excited to learn a new word.
See, we assumed that's why you wanted to talk about it.
Such is my reputation.
The FDA actually thought that people would be allergic to coconuts for a while because of the name.
Because they're a nut.
Oh, well, they're not a nut. So that's sorry, not true.
They're called a nut.
Yeah, the nut allergy fooled the Americans.
Yeah, apparently lots of people are afraid to eat nutmeg as well for the same reason. Well, yeah,
they're missing out. That's one of my favourite fake nuts.
You know it's hallucinogenic.
Yes, I'm well aware. Let's talk about it later, Jack.
They're also not a tree.
No way. No.
What is it then?
So it's actually a really big debate in botany. So I emailed someone at Kew, a lovely Professor Bill Baker.
Kew being the Royal Botanical Gardens.
Yes, exactly.
Okay. Yeah, I thought you were saying the letter Q. I was where's Q? Like Q from James Bond?
Oh yeah, I've got an in. We have our people.
Kew Gardens is a big old botanical garden in Kew, which is a suburb of London.
You can get married there. And they do some fantastic Christmas lights. Talk to us about sponsorship, Q.
No, so he said that loads of people argue about this all the time because it's a palm, which is not a true tree because it lacks secondary growth and the kind of woody hardness. Mm. But, and like confusingly, palms behave like trees. So they've got a really big trunk and a canopy of leaves. So they look just like a tree. But they are not a tree.
They can't run for shit.
It is true. The definition of a tree is to do with kind of how it expands over time and how its bark forms and hardens. Bark forms, which is called vascular cambium. Instead, palms are monocots, which is another big group of plants that includes grasses, orchids, lilies. They don't have the same really, really tough kind of woody structure.
Yeah, which we actually covered, if you recall, in the bananas episode.
We did!
Because the banana's stem is just folded in leaves. So I think that's a bit more clear cut because there's no wood in a banana tree. But I think a coconut tree sort of has wood. It just doesn't expand in the same way.
I see.
So can you talk to me about the life cycle of a coconut? Because obviously the ones that we've got in front of us here are brown and hairy.
Yes.
Shout out brown and hairy things. But when you are on the beach in a tropical area, you are often offered a cold coconut and they're bright green and they're massive. What's going on?
I think it also depends on the kind of coconut because there are two main types.
Okay.
There's the tall version, which is up to 30 meters tall, sometimes over. And it produces a coconut that's like a lot more huskier and there's less water in it. And then
I'm a coconut.
All right.
And then there's a dwarf version, which grows to about half the size. It's still really big. It's like 10 to 15 meters tall. And that's the one that's full of endosperm, which is the liquidy fluid inside. And that's the one that you're offered as a drink.
So the green, the big juicy green ones.
Yeah, it tends to be from a dwarf tree.
But they both start out green, right? So what is often known as a jelly nut is what you're getting on the beach. It's sliced open, you stick a straw in. And then once they're ripened, they dry out a bit, and then you take off an outer layer, which is the mesocarp. And then what we're looking at in front of us, the brown, hairy, hard things, are just the droop. So it's the endocarp,
so
with the liquid inside.
Be like the peach.
Peach stone, yeah.
That's so cool. And then when they're ready to sprout, they'll sprout out of one of these little holes.
Yeah. Aww, I know. Poor sloth face.
Yeah.
Yeah, the vines coming out of his eyes.
The stuff that we eat and make coconut milk out of, so that's the fatty, fleshy bit, and that can also be made into oils, all sorts of stuff. And then...
Gotta say, one of my favourite things in nature is when a vegetable item produces an oil, a natural fat.
That's good, isn't
it? That's cool. Like olives, coconuts, avocado.
Yeah.
I just think to myself, how did we find that out? How did we realise that there was fat in that?
If you're going on an aeroplane, you can't bring copra with you.
What?
And that's the...
the dried flesh, so the white flesh. Bit that you're familiar okay. with.
So the thing where you can't store pistachios together for too
right,
long.
Right, yes, similar.
What, are they flammable as well?
Yeah, apparently if you keep them in really, really big, bulky environments, they can spontaneously combust.
Yes, the friction between them makes so much
there's
heat.
So much heat and so much fat.
Don't tell me they're droops as well.
They are droops.
They are droops. Droops. Oh my God, out here discovering new droops every day.
we mentioned earlier, they're really good at floating.
Mm.
Which is part of the reason it's so hard to pin down where they are from, because they've evolved to be really good at floating across the sea.
Yeah. Oh, really?
They germinate really, really slowly. They've got so much to protect them from the salty water. Mm. So they can last at sea for up to like 110 days.
Wow. Which that's is, like almost half, that's a third of a year, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, it's mad. And they've been known to float for about 4,800 kilometers, which is about the width of the northern United States. So they can travel super, super far. And this means that you get coconuts popping up all over the world in tropical countries where they like to grow. One of the really cool things is the way that the kind of outer layer is shaped is a little bit angular. And there are some people that think that this means that when they float up on the beach, it stops them rolling backwards.
Oh, smart.
Yeah, which is really cool.
That would be a serious evolutionary benefit, mm-hmm. right? So are we saying if you're stuck on a desert island, mm-hmm. which you would hope has coconuts
yes.
of this variety, mm-hmm. if you had some, maybe you got lucky and you got some wood and you got a bit of string or mm-hmm. something, you should actually sort your flotation device out to be strapped up with coconuts because they're really buoyant. Is that something we should say as absolutely. A piece of advice?
And
legitimate
also,
survival advice.
Yeah.
Actually, the Austronesian people, i.e. the people from what we now call as Australia and Papua New Guinea mm-hmm. and all the Nesias, Polynesia, mm-hmm. Micronesia mm-hmm. and Melanesia. Mm-hmm. So Melanesia is basically Papua New Guinea and a few of the nearby islands, including the Solomon Islands. Mm. Micronesia is Palau and the Marshall Islands and various other countries. Mm-hmm. And then to the east of them, a vast swathe of ocean is like Tonga, Samoa, and stretches out to Hawaii. That's mm-hmm. Polynesia. Mm-hmm. Anyway, these people all originally came from Southeast Asia mm-hmm. and they would build boats out of wood, but they would strap them together with coconut husks because right. actually this hairy stuff, which I'm going to talk about later, you can weave and turn into a really strong rope. And because it's resistant to seawater, it lasts so much longer. Mm-hmm. They have tiny little air pockets inside because there's so much lignin. Mm. So it's basically wood fibers. And so that's so the rope itself will float.
That's so cool. Yeah.
And they use them as fishnets as well. Anyway, the coconut basically helps people to travel these vast mm-hmm. distances across the Pacific.
I mean, they are pretty magical, aren't they? Mm-hmm. Good milk, good rope.
Yeah.
It's a droopy fruit.
It is time for our first lunchbox, and today that is you, Rosie.
Predictably, I have brought a curry.
Hooray!
Of course, coconut is used, coconut milk, I should say. No, and coconut meat, coconut flesh is mm-hmm. used in curries all over the world. Today, I want to talk about a very specific technique that happens in Thai cookery,
ooh.
Prevalent in Southeast Asian cooking generally when making curries, but particularly important in Thai cookery. Mm. And that is something that they call cracking the coconut cream. Have you heard of this?
Cracking the coconut cream.
Obviously, you crack a coconut when it's whole and solid and hairy and brown, but you can also crack its cream. I'm going to talk specifically about what's in a tin. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to talk about what's in the fruit. Sorry, the droop.
It's a fruit. It's a fruit.
It's a fruity droop. A fruit, yeah. It's a droopy fruit. So you bought a tin of coconut milk. Hopefully, you're buying a high quality coconut milk with minimal emulsifiers and mm-hmm. additional ingredients and at least 60 to 80% pure coconut.
Yes. Have you ever looked at supermarket coconut brands? Because they vary wildly and it's not even correlated with price. Like sometimes the cheapest one has the most coconut in.
Yeah.
Wait, what's the not coconut?
Water.
It's water and then emulsifiers just to sort of thicken and also to stop it from separating, which is inherently what coconut actual milk will do. Absolutely. It separates because there's a high fat content. what you want is something with minimal emulsifiers. Mm-hmm. And there are two brands that I will recommend now. Other brands are available, but these are the best ones. In the UK, you can get a brand called Aroy D.
Oh, yeah.
And you can also get Chow Co. Those are the two shit hot coconut milks.
Very nice.
I have some Aroy D in my cupboard right now, and I put some in the fridge earlier.
Mm.
Why did I put it in the fridge, you wonder? I'm sure you're just desperate to know. The way to make your coconut milk heavily emulsified in its can separate into cream and more of a watery consistency of milk is to chill it.
Okay.
Because that cream at the top has the highest fat content, and that is what you can crack in a pan. And when I say crack, I mean split.
Interesting.
Okay. Split the emulsification. How do you split it? With heat.
Okay. Are you going to keep going like this?
Uh-huh.
Yes.
Why won't I? This is how I've done all my voice notes in WhatsApp this week.
That's great. That's great.
Do I have keep time going. To see you? No. It's all rhetorical questions. Anyway, in Thai recipes, in Thai cooking, very often you will start your curry with coconut cream that you crack it in the pan to get out the oil that is in the cream to fry your curry paste.
Okay.
This is why some recipes might not have any oil quantity at the beginning at all. They'll just say, put the coconut cream in the pan, bring it to the boil, crack it, add your curry paste and fry it. This is obviously going to be in more trad Thai cookery. Okay. Mm-hmm. So you're not going to find this in like a Sainsbury's recipe or a BBC Good Food, no offense. For really traditional curries, the building of a curry, you would start by cracking the coconut cream.
Okay, so what happens to the not oil content?
Great question. I'm about to go there. I experimented earlier with this because I haven't done it in ages. I don't actually cook that much Thai food at home, mainly because I just don't. I'm not very like
so hard.
It's really
it's
hard.
It's insanely
it's
hard.
Really
traditional Thai cooking is one of the most complicated cuisines 100% on the planet. It's insane.
And it's like, I have a thing of like, I don't want to do something no justice, you know? I want to do it well if I'm going to do it. And I don't always have the like time, energy, resources, you know, the great ingredients that I need to do a Thai curry justice. So I won't make it.
Mm-hmm. I completely agree. I like to make mine from scratch, but I have to go to Chinatown and get proper galangal, proper lemongrass, and then blitz
and
it
I also around. Want to use a recipe written by a Thai person. Mm-hmm. And actually that's so hard to find. And I was like racking my brains, like who's written a really good Thai cookbook recently that's actually Thai. I actually asked for one for my birthday. Where was that, Tom? Classy, do you want to eat some curry? This is a Penang.
Waiting for that moment.
Yeah, I know, sorry. This is a Penang curry. Ooh. My favourite curry from Thai cookery. And it's got chicken in it.
Going in straight in. Ooh, there's beans. There's all sorts.
Right. In Thai cooking, there is a different understanding of how to use coconut cream versus coconut milk, which is the thinner, less fatty part of what you would find in a tin of coconut milk.
Like yogurt to Greek yogurt.
Exactly. Ooh. No. Not really.
But milk to cream?
It's literally milk to cream. Okay. Yeah, that's exactly right. The fat bit is the cream, the thinner bit is the milk. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
And actually, in Thai, the top layer is referred to as hua gati, which is the coconut milk head. Mm. And the bottom bit is referred to as hang gati, which is the coconut milk tail, which I thought was very poetic.
Very nice.
I thought you were going to say arse.
Yeah, that is what I was expecting as well.
So basically, what happens is you put your coconut cream in a pan, heat it consistently, and it will not happen instantly. This is something that takes a bit of time. Okay. You do need to have patience. And I think that's where people went wrong, because I found a lot of Reddit threads of people being like, this didn't work. I can't spit my coconut milk. You can do it. I literally did it today. If you chill it down, you separate the cream from the milk just by chilling it down in the fridge and take that top bit, you can crack it, but you just have to be patient. Mm-hmm. So you leave it in the pan on a medium heat and it will start to bubble around the edges. It will be thin initially when it comes into contact with a hot pan. It will thin down straight away. But then you keep whisking it and it will thicken and thicken and thicken, and the bubbles kind of creep towards the middle, a bit like when you're making a caramel.
Okay.
Essentially what you're doing is you're evaporating all of that water, or as much water as possible, so that the fat starts to appear. Oh. It's actually quite hard to see, I found, but essentially where I got to was like a really bubbly, so thick, and it's reduced in quantity as well. Mm. You might, if you look really closely, I mean, you don't want to stick your head in a boiling hot pan, but mm-hmm. you might it's be able yourself. To see like this little tiny rivulets of oil are coming out. Mm-hmm. It's at that point that you add your paste. Mm-hmm. Assuming your paste has no oil in it, mm-hmm. you will instantly see oil seeping out. From what I could tell is that you need a bit of acid to go in the pan to mm-hmm. finish the splitting, because that actually properly means that suddenly there's like this oily paste. And I was just like, whoa. I'm frying my paste in my oil. I can't believe it. It's cracked. I cracked it.
You cracked it.
If you don't do that, a lot of people clearly on Reddit were having these issues where they're not cracking it properly. So when they add the paste in, it's still a liquid. So mm-hmm. it's just boiling. So sometimes you might have made a curry this way and it tastes really like insipid, and you're getting this like really raw flavor from your garlic and your onion. That's because it wasn't fried. Mm-hmm. You cannot fry something in no fat. If you put something in a liquid, so it is boiled. So, top tip for cracking coconut cream, use good coconut milk. Keep it in the fridge, ideally 24 hours before you're going to make it. But 2 hours is fine. That's what I did today and it worked perfectly. Do not shake your cans of coconut milk.
Oh, see, I always do that.
No, see, that's where you're going wrong, because you're essentially re-emulsifying.
Exactly. That, but that's what I thought the point was. I wanted to get it back to a consistent
state. Well, in some cases,
state.
You want emulsified coconut milk. But mm-hmm. in Thai curries, I don't know if you've noticed, but there's often sort of like a thin layer of oil on the top. Mm. And actually, lots of curries from Southeast Asian cookery and mm-hmm. Indian cookery, oil on the top is very important. We are obsessed with emulsifications in Western cooking. Mm-hmm. And it's not the case in more Eastern cuisines. Like, they actually want to see a bit of that fat top, because it means mm-hmm. the spices have been cooked properly. Mm-hmm. It means there's been a proper... Yeah. build of a curry, right?
And it's the best bit at the end when it's you swipe the best bit.
It tells me that that's been made properly.
Mm-hmm. Have you seen the ingenious method they well maybe it's just common to all chefs, but I saw a Thai cook on YouTube somewhere getting excess fat from the top of their curry, and it's during the cooking process. They basically had a big block of ice, and then you put the ice just in the top.
Yeah.
And then it solidifies the fat because it gets cold and gets to solid temperature. And then you can just scrape a layer off and then you do it again.
Yeah. But why would you? The fat's good.
Yeah, yeah. But you like the fat. One can have too much.
Totally. Yeah. no, but I mean, like, that is a great, that's what you'd often do in like French cuisine as well. If you make a sauce, you would chill it down, mm-hmm. skim the fat off.
So it's not unique to Thai
people. No. But that, I like that it's like during. Yes. Like the block of ice in, block of ice out. Anyway, I like to use a whisk. I think it's a good piece of kit because it means you're constantly getting the bottom up, so nothing is sticking. Also recommend a stainless steel pan if you can mm-hmm. use one. Oh. And most importantly, a wide-based pan mm-hmm. because everything will happen quicker if you've got more surface area for mm-hmm. water to evaporate. So don't try and crack your coconut milk in your smallest, deepest pan. Mm-hmm. That's actually going to be counterintuitive.
Thin, tall pan.
Yeah, exactly.
I thought you were going to talk about how to actually literally crack open a coconut.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
I mean, from memory, I've done it a couple of times for shoots. Right. It was chaotic as hell because I have not cracked that many coconuts in my life. But basically, you whack it all around the equator mm-hmm. of the coconut. So the whole way around is weakened. And then you stab it with a machete.
I want to talk about a different coconut product, which is palm wine. Mm. So if you get the immature coconut.
I didn't know that was from I thought it was from palms. Yeah, but obviously they are coconut trees. So
a subsection of the palm is the coconut palm. So basically they get their water inside them from filtered sap. So if you get really young coconuts and cut them open, the natural yeast start fermenting them so that you can have coconut wine within an hour.
Whoa.
It'll be about 4%.
That's no so way.
Yeah, yeah. And then, but if you leave it too long, then it becomes vinegar.
It's quite strong palm wine from what I've heard. No,
well, I think commercially available palm wine, you can distill it or like much like you would a spirit.
The rumors about coconut water are that it's got tons of electrolytes mm-hmm. and it's really, really good for you. The wellness industry went hard for coconut water mm-hmm. a few years ago.
Oh yeah.
What's the truth? What are we saying? Is it actually good for you?
Well, that is actually what my lunchbox is about. So shall we move on and find out?
Please.
Time
time for our second lunchbox, and today that is mine. I have brought lots of different kinds of coconut water, which I'm going to take intravenously.
Okay. Oh,
did you bring yourself a little drip?
You know what? I did actually try and find a drip for today. It's really hard to find drips last minute.
You're probably on some list somewhere.
Not a medical professional.
Yeah, I think there's probably some stringent laws around that.
I bought three different kinds of coconut water for us to sample. See which one you prefer, which one you'd like to have pumped into your body at some point.
They're all quite different looking. Yeah. This one, oh, I can see there's some sediment
there. It's a little bit of pulp.
But it's also nice and clear. It's the clearest of them all, even though it looks like a jellyfish did a poo in it.
Jellyfish famously doesn't have an anus.
Okay, all right. You're such a pedant. Okay, next one is the most milky looking. Mm. It's opaque and white. And then this one is essentially yellow.
I think it's in a green glass.
It is also in a green glass. Okay. But it's got no sediment, notably. Mm. So that makes me like it the most.
Would you like to sample any?
Yeah, let's
orally
do it.
Yeah. Versus
orally. Orally versus intravenously. Incredibly sweet.
Is it?
And caramelly. Oh my God, that's really good.
Oh, that one's nice. To take intravenously is not recommended.
Okay.
But it has been done in the past. So coconut water does have a certain amount of salts and sugars in it, which makes it kind of similar to blood plasma.
Interesting.
Oh. And what you can do if you're in a serious, serious pinch is you can use an IV drip with coconut water in it as a hydration technique.
Wow.
It was used sometimes in emergency situations, say during World War II, in the Vietnam War. But it's much better to use like a proper IV saline solution to do this. You can use coconut water to hydrate yourself the normal way with your mouth and by drinking it.
Any word on coconut enemas?
Yeah, you know what's the chat about coconut enema?
I actually didn't find any, but I 100%.
Well, I've got 100 pages of notes here. Let me tell you. No, mostly pictures, actually.
So it's actually a really good form of oral rehydration therapy, which is basically just drinking. And a lot of doctors.
Oral rehydration therapy sounds like something that they're going to charge you to do on Harley Street, and it's like drink a glass of water.
Yeah. But some doctors recommend coconut water if you've become seriously dehydrated. Say if you've got like stomach issues or Crohn's disease, it can be a little bit easier to absorb than straight up water because it's got that kind of electrolyte balance.
Okay, so it's not a lie.
It's not a lie.
It's hydrating.
It is hydrating, but it's not like this kind of miracle kind of fluid that a lot of people think it is.
That's what I thought when I had hangovers and would drink it and was like, why don't I feel instantly better?
But it is better than straight up water because it's got some sugar, it's got some salt, but it doesn't have to be coconut water.
No, okay, fine.
So when you're drinking alcohol, that's oral dehydration therapy, I guess.
Would you like to go to the pub for some oral dehydration therapy?
So we've got a version here that's very much living by the coconut. You're being saved by coconuts. Mm-hmm. There are also other animals that use coconuts for survival. One is the octopus, which I love so much.
That's interesting. They live in the sea.
They do live in the sea. But a lot of people throw coconut shells into the sea after they've harvested all of the flesh and the milk. Mm. And in 2009, there were a group of marine biologists who observed octopuses collecting two halves of a split coconut shell and like walking along the seafloor with them like awkwardly tucked under their bodies.
Banging them together.
I was going to say like there's a mic and they're making sound effects.
Anyway, so they were like walking this really weird way with coconuts tucked under themselves. And everyone was like, what is happening? And then they realized that they were using them as tiny houses. Aww. So on really long stretches of the seafloor where there's no shelter, when they felt a bit afraid, they just like into the coconut shell and like close it around them like a little house, which is really nice.
So is this a behavior that's directly resulting from humans littering coconut shells in the sea, or do they do this with other, you know, shells?
Yes, they will actually use other things in the ocean, not just coconuts. So they might use shells, Apparently, they've been seen using other bits of litter as well to protect themselves, which is not the most fun. But they're just like excellent improvisers because it's a dangerous place, the open ocean floor. Yeah.
So about what I'm taking from this is chuck all your litter in the ocean so that it's you can provide homes for octopuses.
This is also evidence of tool use in octopuses. Oh,
yes, of course.
Because it requires quite a lot of advanced planning. So there's a difference between having something on you all the time. So say like a hermit crab, it also collects shells to wear, but it's just on its back. It's not really thinking about it much. It's like, I need this, I got it, boosh, done. Whereas an octopus is taking the coconut and it's actually a hindrance whilst it's walking. It doesn't make sense. It's not useful all the time, but then in that moment it becomes really useful. So that's what makes it tool use.
Yeah, yeah.
It's really cool. Another fantastic use of coconuts for survival is in coconut armor.
Oh, yeah.
This is my favorite thing. So in Kiribati, so it's an archipelago, which is actually the earliest it can possibly be in time, in modern,
I think I know what you're going
It's
for.
So cool. So the international dateline basically kind of goes straight down the earth and it divides kind of like one day from another.
In the Pacific, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So on one side of the line, it's 12 o'clock on a Saturday. And then on the other side of that line, it will be 12 o'clock on a Friday. So big, big difference.
For example. Right.
For example. But because if it went perfectly straight through this archipelago, it would create absolute chaos in terms of dates and times in that collection of islands. So they've neatly drawn around it. So they start their New Year
fest. You don't have your neighbours like at 24 hours ahead of you.
Yes, exactly. So there is a fantastic video by one of the curators in the British Museum called Julie Adams. And she walks us through a coconut suit of armour that's built by indigenous Kiribati people. They're called e-Kiribati. And people from the islands. So it's made out of lots of tekora, which is the name for the coconut cord. And it's like really, really intricately woven. Their weapons are made from like coconut fibers and shark teeth. And it's all woven together with this material. They've got helmets made out of a kind of pufferfish animal. So they look really spiky.
Oh my God,
it's
amazing.
So, so
Fugu
cool.
Helmets.
Very similar, very similar. And it's really interesting because the outfits were so complicated to make. It's really unlikely that they were used in really aggressive forms of combat. It was probably more ritual. Okay. But they also have a really interesting way of dealing with disputes historically on the island. Mm. So if you were going to go to war with another village about, say, like property or land or sea rights and fishing rights, you might don this outfit and you might go and have a scuffle, but the point was to wound your opponent and not to kill them.
Okay.
And if you killed them, you would also lose privileges. So it's a way to settle disputes, but also minimize death.
That's quite progressive.
Ah, it's really nice.
I'm picturing like paintball when you get hit. You're just like, oh, sorry, I'm out. Yeah. And then you just get free passage and you can go and recover on the sidelines.
Just on dying by coconuts.
Oh, yeah.
There was a really famous stat going around that more people are killed by falling coconuts than they are by sharks.
Yes, 10 times more.
Mm-hmm.
And that's true?
No.
Incorrect.
It's unproven. No one's done a good enough study of how many people die via coconut falling.
Yeah.
Right.
Shark deaths are kept track of really, really well. Yeah,
they're about 6 a year worldwide.
I did find one study done in the Solomon Islands in 2001 that looked at coconut-related injuries between 1994 and 1999. And it found that 3.4% of the injuries at the A&E at that time were caused by coconuts, which isn't massive. There was roughly 85 patients who'd fallen from the tree, 16 who had had a fruit fall on them.
Okay.
Three of them had had a tree fall on them, had had the palm fall on them.
That is dangerous.
And then one patient had just kicked a coconut palm really, really hard.
Because he was angry.
And then it fell on his head and he died.
No. None of them died.
He was just hurt.
Oh, okay.
But the main conclusion from that paper was like, make sure you warn kids not to.
Yeah, you can see how it would be dangerous, but it's also quite unlikely.
Yeah. Okay, well, that makes me feel better because whenever I have been in a country where coconuts are wild, I've always been a bit like, I need to look up. Is there a coconut about to drop on my head?
Do that. Don't chill out too hard under a coconut tree.
Well, it's the same with sharks. Like, don't like go towards a shark.
I mean, Jack, there's literally nothing you could tell me There's nothing you need to tell me twice less than don't go to a shark. I'm mortally afraid of sharks.
I managed to find someone who did die from a coconut. Mm-hmm. Yeah. In 1932, there was an American who was trying to open his coconut with the butt of his gun.
Oh, and then
it happened to be loaded and it went off and shot him in the stomach and he died of his wounds.
Oh, God. There's also this guy that used a hand grenade as a nutcracker for years.
Oh, yes, I saw that.
So funny.
What, he would throw it into a pile of nuts?
What would he do with it? Single use, right? No, he didn't know it was a grenade. It was just like a heavy stick and he was whacking his nuts for like decades. There's also evidence of coconut shells being used in cranioplasties. Which is a different sort of armor.
And what, as in like the surgery?
Yeah, yeah. So if your skull has been crushed in, you have to sort of replace the structure with something to, and modern day cranioplasties use a polymer which allows the bone to sort of fuse back and is completely sort of safe from infection. No, it stays in there. But like back in the day, and again in extremis, if you get a small section of the coconut shell, you can use that as a skull transplant, basically.
Oh my God.
It's obviously a huge infection risk.
Yeah,
so.
Well,
and the risk of you developing an incredibly tropical personality.
just smell of lilt for the rest of your life.
Pina coladas every day.
And it's weird to think if you were hit on the head with a coconut, you might then use that same coconut to fix your broken skull.
Luckily, the fool cracked the coconut and we can now use it in a surgery.
It is time for our final lunchbox, and today that is Jack.
I brought something completely inedible.
That's my job normally.
Yeah.
So I've brought this coconut husk brick.
Oh my God.
This is made of a thing called coir, C-O-I-R. It's used in gardening because it makes quite good compost. So coir is basically the fabric that you get from it's the hairs from the coconut, basically. As we said earlier, it's used for ropes. And it's used for thatch, and it's used for Kiribatian armour. Mm-hmm. And actually, you might recognise it from your doormat. Because if you have one of those brown, scratchy doormats, they're made from coir.
I can't believe that all these coconuts have the letters for get the fuck out on them. That's so crazy. I didn't know that. I thought that was just naturally occurring on my doormat. There's a type of carpet very specific to like austere British houses, a bit like my parents. And no, I'm joking, mum, dad, that's not austere, it's lovely. But they had a carpet that was like woven fabric and it was called coir.
Yeah, it'll be the same thing.
But it was spelt like, you know, the Farrow and Ball version of coir. It was Q-U-I-R-E.
That's so funny. I bet that's the same thing.
But I was like, that makes me think of coir, right?
Actually, there was a guy who introduced, he was the foremost rug seller in London in the 1800s. And he started a shop. He was called Thomas Treloar. And he had a shop in the 1840s in Ludgate Hill, and he declared the fabric to be versatile, comfortable, and obnoxious to vermin. By 1904, he had two shops in central London, and he claimed to have carpeted the road between the two with Turkish rugs, which would have been a nightmare for people tripping over all the time, and they get very dirty.
Definitely, the dog shit on that.
Imagine the cleaning video afterwards, though. Oh. You guys watch those?
Oh. I'm not really into the cleaning videos. As you know, all I want to do is listen to people eat.
I'm watching the rugs getting sprayed and so really.
Going back to the brick, that's used as compost because it's full of lignin, so it retains moisture, and actually is quite bouncy, so that it actually keeps the soil aerated. They use coir bricks a bit like this one because they swell up to about 15 times the size if they get wet.
Get enormous.
But they're used to clean up oil spills as well. There's so many uses. I couldn't list them all. It's also used to filter sewage in Brazil.
Okay. Really?
And make cool boxes in America. Because if you imagine like a coconut under the hot tropical sun, whenever you cut them open, cold inside.
Lovely and chilled. Ooh. Well, not chilled, but you know, not hot. Yeah.
So that's incredibly thermally insulative. And they actually even make charcoal out of coir. So they make charcoal briquettes in Sierra Leone. And it's static free, unlike a lot of plastics. A lot of the seats in cars are stuffed with it.
Really?
Yeah.
So my question always when you tell me about the million and one useful uses of something. It's like, are they byproducts during the making of coconut milk and coconut oil? Or does all of this come from those industries?
It's a good question. There are actually two different types of coconut. So there's a type known as new kaffa, which has much more coir and therefore hair, but very little flesh. Ah. So you grow the new kaffa type. Most coir comes from India and Sri Lanka. They dominate the market.
Right.
Sri Lanka is the biggest exporter of coir in the world.
Just on how they are harvested and made, did you know you can train monkeys to gather coconuts for you?
No way.
Wow.
Yes, you can.
That's so cool.
And they are very good at it. Particularly pigtailed macaques, which are in the areas that these coconuts are harvested, so Thailand predominantly, can collect up to 1,000 coconuts a day.
All right. Which is that a lot?
It's quite a lot. So basically, if humans are doing it, they tend to use really, really long sticks with blades on the end of them. So you kind of push them up the tree and then you yank them down and then you collect them when they're falling. But a monkey can stay in the tree for quite a long time and continuously throw the coconuts that they're picking.
Wow.
Slight issue is that this means that your coconut might not be vegan because it relies on animal labor. Often these monkeys are tremendously mistreated. So this story actually blew up in 2019 when PETA, the People for Ethical Treatment of Animals, released a report about monkey coconut picking in Thailand. And then like a load of UK supermarkets dropped lots of coconut products that were being picked by monkeys.
I read that they'd been trained for 400 years, actually. And NPR ran an article about it. And they suggested that 99% of Thai coconut farmers used monkeys, which I think is a bit extreme.
Really,
and actually, since the backlash, because that was 10 years ago, 11 years ago, there are very few of them. In fact, the Thai official minister for agriculture, I think, said very few of our farms use them now. Humans are used in the, have you heard of the Micronesian Games?
I have not heard of it.
So it's kind of like the Olympics, but just for Micronesian nations. Mm-hmm. They do volleyball, spearfishing, and coconut tree climbing.
Ooh.
So yeah, that's against the clock, I think.
That's cool.
Yeah.
I've really enjoyed how dynamic and versatile coconuts are and actually how much they offer the world as a product.
It's called the tree of life in many places.
Is it?
They give so much, kind of like how olive trees were like this god.
The Mediterranean
exactly.
version.
This, yeah, very much so.
Interesting. But I'm going to romantically and very idealistically say they're a good thing.
Yeah.
And I like them.
So.
That is it for this week's edition of Lunchbox Envy.
You can follow our socials for foodie facts and podcast updates. We are on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, and TikTok at Lunchbox Envy Pod.
You can also get in touch and send us your facts, recipes, and questions by emailing us, lunchbox@qi.com.
And we'll leave you with this. In 1943, during World War II, John F. Kennedy was stranded in the Solomon Islands after his patrol boat was destroyed. He carved an SOS message onto a coconut shell and gave it to two local islanders who delivered it to a nearby Allied base. Kennedy was rescued, and years later, as president, he kept the engraved coconut on his desk in the Oval Office as a paperweight. We'll see you next week. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Lunchbox Envy was hosted by Rosie McKean, Jack Chambers, and me, Manu Onrio. It was produced by Alex Bell. This has been a quite interesting podcast.